When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYN ads.com.
Hello and welcome to this week's Intelligence Squared podcast with me, Farah Jassat.
And me, Daniel Ben-Koren.
This week we speak to Chris Hurst, the CEO of advertising agency Havas, about leadership. Daniel, he's written a book, hasn't he?
Yep, his book is called No Bullshit Leadership, excuse my French. And it's his own practical guidelines for running a company. Obviously, Havas is one of the biggest advertising companies in the world. So Helen Lewis, who is a staff writer at The Atlantic, asked him about his own unique philosophy. We hope you enjoy listening.
And just before we go to this week's episode, if you're interested in coming to any of the Intelligence Squared events that happen live in London, go on our website at intelligencesquared.com and we can offer you a special 20% discount. Just type in the promo code podcast at the checkout.
Hello, I'm Helen Lewis, staff writer at The Atlantic, and welcome to this week's Intelligence Squared podcast. You can sign up for regular updates about podcasts and other events at intelligencesquared.com. Hello, Chris. The book is kind of a blast against what you call the leadership industrial complex, right? So can you explain to us what that is?
I think the leadership industrial complex is a very broad and loosely defined by me group of organisations that I would include everything from at one end, organisations we're all in some ways familiar with, by the way. So at one end, that might be management consultants, some training organizations, conferences, off-site sessions that many of us will be familiar with, business schools, dare I say it, books. And the common factor between these is that I think the leadership industrial complex has, in some instances, a vested interest, and in some instances, maybe an accidental interest in making the subject of leadership seem really, really difficult. And certainly for those that make a lot of money out of the leadership business, I think it's definitely in their interests to make it sound really complicated, because, of course, then they're the answer.
Right. So you have this saying in the book that leadership is difficult but not complicated. Mm-hmm. So why, first of all, why is it so difficult?
I think it's difficult because leadership is, I think I probably have to take a little step back and talk about what I think leadership is first in order to be able to really do that question justice. So first of all, what is a leader? Well, my definition of a leader is anybody that has people they're responsible for, which is why I talk about everyday leaders. So that's a very large part of our society. And what is leadership? Leadership for me is the getting of a group of people, and it's always people, from a defined point in the present to a different and clearly defined point in the future. So that's what I think leadership is. So leadership is about change. And the reason leadership is so difficult is because I think the defining of those two endpoints is often by the leadership industrial complex. We're told that that's a very complicated thing to do. I'm saying that that isn't necessarily. What is very, very difficult is the getting between the two. And it's difficult because it involves action and execution and people and taking decisions and the high chance, if not inevitability, of failures along the way. And those things are difficult both to often it's difficult to do and take decisions, but often it can be very difficult emotionally and personally as well.
Okay, so let's take a step back and talk about how you came to write this book. Kind of whisk us through your CV then. What is your interest, personal interest in this subject?
So the very short version of my CV is I have worked in creative advertising agencies for most of my career. Latterly, I have a slightly wider remit than that, but for the purposes of your question, advertising agencies. But I think that probably the most relevant and specific part is the period where I really started to think about what leadership is and genuinely think about, therefore, what is it and how can it be done well, and obviously how is it done badly. Mm-hmm. And my own personal journey along that was that in about when I was in my early 30s, so this is about 2002-2003, I was hired as part of a kind of Young Turks management team, five of us, and to go in and fix a broken business. And it was it was the unfixable business within the industry. And we were hired, and within about 12 months of the five of us, one had been fired and most of the others had left and gone on to subsequently fabulously successful careers elsewhere. And after 6 years, I was still there. I'd been passed over at least twice, I think, to be the CEO. And the business, frankly, was just as much of a dog as it had been at the start. So I could certainly no longer claim to be part of the solution. I'd become part of the problem. I mean, after 6 years, you haven't fixed it. That's the truth, right? So I was sitting there at that point, so now we're in about 2009, thinking, well, I think I've screwed my career. I mean, you know, I joined as this kind of part of this rock star team, and now I'm just lost in this crappy agency. What am I going to do? And then I got lucky, honestly. And again, the short version of the story is I got lucky and I persuaded my employer to pay for me to go to Harvard for 8 weeks. And I went to do the advanced management program at Harvard. And there's a whole separate story about that experience. But the real relevant piece for this is not any great insight I learned about leadership at Harvard. I know I've just knocked business school, so I have the self-awareness to recognize that. What it really gave me was it gave me space. At that point in my career, it gave me space. And it gave me space to reflect on myself and reflect on, you know, what I wanted to do next and all that kind of stuff. And I got lucky when I came back in that my new boss got promoted and I got put suddenly, pretty well unexpectedly, into the CEO role of this still broken agency. And at that point, it was literally then that for the first time in my career, I thought to myself about what a leader really needs to do and what leadership really is. And the one thing I was sure about at that point, I wasn't sure about many things, but the one thing I was sure about is that I wasn't going to make the mistakes that I'd seen made by myself and others over the preceding 6 years. Mm-hmm. And I suppose really that was the start of my leadership journey.
Which is quite, I mean, it is inspirational in the way that actually, presumably you now think it was right to pass over you for CEO those previous times, or do you still feel a little bit of a niggle about that?
I think it was right. I think it was right because I think I hadn't worked out. I mean, I think one of the key things that defines good leaders is they have a conscious point of view on what leadership is. It doesn't mean it has to be the same as my point of view, by the way. They could vigorously disagree with my point of view. The most important thing, I obviously would say the second most important thing is to agree with me, but definitely the most important thing is to just have a point of view. And I think that I think I, in common with quite a lot of people, had seen the various progressions of my career as to each next job being roughly the same as the one before, only with a bit more responsibility and a bit more money. But actually, when you get into real leadership positions, like a CEO position of a business, it is a completely different job. And I think I hadn't got to that place in my own head at that point.
Yeah, I mean, I think what you're talking about is interesting because one of the things I think that holds people back from wanting to be leaders and do leadership roles is wanting to be liked. And actually, the fact is, particularly when you're in a company where you get promoted up from the ranks, as it were, suddenly you're not one of the guys. You know, you can't all go to the pub together and bitch about the boss because that's you now, right? And it would be inappropriate for you to keep doing that about the next level up. There's a kind of separation. It's being a leader is kind of slightly lonely, right?
I think leadership can be lonely. I don't think it necessarily. I mean, it's hard. I think generalizations are different people's experiences of leadership and anything else, frankly, are quite difficult to generalise about. But I think it can be lonely. And I certainly have found it lonely at times. And I think your point about being liked is an interesting one. I mean, it's the military example is the classic, isn't it? You know, the private who suddenly gets made the Lance Corporal or something, and suddenly he's got to tell the guys what to do. And in fact, there's lots of anecdotes of people deliberately not taking promotions for exactly that reason, because they want to stay as part of the gang. But I think that I agree with you totally in the sense that being liked it isn't necessary to be liked to be a good leader. I mean, by the way, it is possible to be a good leader and be liked. I mean, they're not mutually exclusive. But if you think about my definition of leadership, being liked isn't in there as a prerequisite.
I just think when I've thought about this subject, like I used to lead a team, which I know I've now sort of moved sideways out of that. A lot of it is a bit like, it reminds me about books on parenting in a way, right? About wanting to be like your kid's friend. And actually that's not what they need. They need a parent. Mm. And there's a sort of similar thing with leadership where you need people to respect you and like you, but actually people like the reassurance of a hierarchy some of the time. You talk in the book about the fact that people would come and, you know, sort of dump their problems on you on a Friday afternoon and then go off to the pub, happy in the knowledge that someone else had shared it. And there is a kind of sense that actually a lot of people like the security of having a leader. That's what it is. It is a slightly parental kind of figure.
That we'll come to the parental points. I think that is an interesting analogy to explore in terms of the pros and cons. I think for sure people want to have good leaders. And we can have, you know, again, lots of different conversations about how you might define a good leader. But my attempt at that is particularly in a career sense. I mean, this is, leadership exists in lots of other fields as well. But in a career sense, I think one way of thinking about a good leader is somebody who is, are you good for the careers of the people that work for you? And I think most people want to have successful careers. That doesn't mean necessarily that for most people career is a be all and end all. But for, if I have to spend 5 days a week or even 3 days a week, whatever, 9 till 5, you know, I want that to be a successful experience for me. And that, by the way, that can be very individual and very different. Mm-hmm. But nevertheless, I quite like that as a question because you can make that mean lots of different things for yourself. But I think a successful leader, a great measure is if you're good for the careers that work for you, careers for the people that work for you, you by definition are doing a lot of things right.
Yeah.
You both understand them individually, so there's a micro element to it. But I think also for you to be good for somebody's career, you also have to be doing a lot of macro things right. You know, you have to be running a successful team or a successful organisation. So I quite like that as a measure. And again, within that, there's nothing about being liked. I do think respect is important. I think that is a prerequisite, but that's a completely different point. I think the parental thing is interesting, and I think there are some analogies with parenting, but at the same time, I certainly think in today's society, not just business, but society, I think our relationship with authority is very different to what it was maybe even 10 years ago, certainly than it was 20 or 30 years ago. And a lot of organisations did. The hierarchies in organisations were quite parental in that sense. And I think there's a lot of class aspects in there as well. I think the problem with the parental analogy is you end up with what I call dependent cultures.
Right. So this is a big theme about the book, about the kind of fact that if you end up in an overly rigid management style, everybody skulks around desperately not taking any decisions on their own behalf because they know they could be countermanded or they're going to get in trouble for having overstepped the mark, which leads to I've worked in an organisation like this, a very dysfunctional organisation where everything comes down to the say of one person and that person can't be everywhere at all times. So everyone else functionally might as well not be there the rest of the time because they're all waiting on one person's sign off, which I'm sure advertising, you talk about the kind of Don Draper model, the kind of... Yeah, creative director kind of being the kind of god must be prone to that too.
Oh, I mean that's where I've worked in advertising agencies. Yeah. I mean those are the environments I spent a lot of my career in. Yeah, I think that to go back to this sort of this tipping point moment for me personally, when I became the CEO, finally get put in charge of this crappy business. One of the things I was determined, and I'm saying we, because it was a leadership team at that point. We were determined to be really quite iconoclastic and pretty well set about smashing up all of the things within the organisation and within the culture that we felt represented that style of what I call the Caesars in the book, the people in the corner offices with the white leather sofas and the closed doors, and removing everything that showed signs of that. And so that's that was physical changes to the environment, that was cultural changes, that was process changes to get rid of that. And the point is exactly as you describe it. I think if you have an organisation where you have have these Don Draper, these Caesar type figures. And by the way, they exist in all sorts of organizations. Mm. I mean, you're talking about a very different organization to an advertising agency. The problem is within particularly people-based businesses, but again, I think many types of organizations, if you have, you know, the organizations are full of ambitious, bright, often quite well-paid people, all of whom want to get on with their careers. And yet, if you have this kind of parental culture, it does say to those people, do you know what? It really doesn't matter what you think or what you say. Only one person's opinion matters. And not only is that deeply frustrating and dysfunctional to work within, as you mentioned, my argument is actually you fail to unlock the potential of all those other people in that organization. And the real challenge for leader is, my analogy is about height. You know, some leaders, you feel like they make everybody feel like they're a foot shorter than they actually are. And actually, great leaders, you want everybody to feel like they're 2 foot taller than they actually are. That, you know, that's what a leader needs to do. A leader needs to create an environment for their team to outperform. And I don't think you can do that if you have a parent-child approach.
But do you then need to have an acceptance that some people will do things differently to the way you would have done them? And I think that's one of the things that is difficult for leaders to give up, is that particularly as you get more and more authority over time, you begin to think your way is the right way and you want things done your way. And like you kind of get into a kind of comfort zone at work. And actually, it's very hard to then say, I wouldn't have done it like that, but let's find out if that's a legitimate way to do it, right? Because I think that lies behind a lot of Caesar, as you talk about these Caesars, you know, they just want things their way and they're not open to the idea that anyone else might have a kind of good idea.
I think that is exactly the leader's challenge. My argument is exactly that. To be an effective leader, you have to create an environment for people to perform at their best. And them performing at their best is not trying to copy you.
Let's talk about it from the other way around, of managing up. What do you do if you have one of those leaders who is a Caesar, who just wants things done their way? How do you functionally cope with that and sort of say, hey, I know that, you know, this isn't the way you would have done it, but this is, well, let's try it. You know, you need to have a bit more kind of, you know, investment in your team to have a bit more respect for them.
I think, well, it's a question I get asked a lot. And at the end of the day, I don't think there's any really simple answers to that. I think I would encourage people to be brave and be bold, and first of all, to have those conversations. And I don't think, and again, hard to generalize, I don't think you have to necessarily approach those kind of difficult conversations with your bosses. And we've all got bosses, you know, I've got bosses. I don't think you have to approach that in a, you know, you're wrong, I'm right way. Mm. But I do think that even if people do have those kind of management styles that I'm saying, that I'm not sure that's necessarily that helpful. It doesn't mean that those people are bad people. It doesn't mean that those people don't, you know, they will tell themselves they do want to hear everybody's like, nobody ever says, I'm right, you're all wrong, only do it my way. So the first thing is to have the courage to go and have those conversations, to go and have conversations about, here's something I think, here's my ideas, here's my suggestions. So the first thing I think is to push and try. I mean, there isn't a way around that. Mm-hmm. That all said, I've always thought that today, more than ever, people have choices. And at the end of the day, if you're in an environment, in an organization, that you don't think you're enjoying or you're not getting what you need out of that organization, and you do feel like you've genuinely tried to get those questions answered, at the end of the day, the only answer is to go and work somewhere else. And I think that's the leader's challenge, because people are making those choices all the time. And you as a leader, you have to make sure that you're creating an environment that people are choosing you. And you know, increasingly, we're in a very fluid world now from an employment point of view. People want to have more fluid careers. You know, a career is almost getting to a point where there's not a standard career anymore. You know, people have all sorts of different working patterns and ambitions. And as a leader, you need to recognize that the more talented people are, the more choices they have. And you need them to choose you. It's not about you choosing them so much anymore. Because, you know, they're the one with the power and the choice in that sense. Mm. So you've got to create an environment where they're choosing you. And at the end of the day, if they feel like you're not good for their career, they're going to go somewhere else.
Okay, next problem for the Chris Hess Leadership Clinic. Say you're a CEO or a senior leader. What do you about middle managers who are not quite up to it and therefore do a lot of work, busy work, in order to camouflage the fact that none of the work is of any good quality? Because I think a lot of people will recognise that figure in the office too.
A lot of people recognise that figure.
Is it just about getting rid of them? Because there is a very good bit in the book about the fact that people don't like the idea that sometimes actually things just don't work out and a bad individual can ruin a whole team.
There's no question that a bad individual can ruin a whole team. I mean, my way, there's the sort of the cliche about, you know, your greatest assets get in the lift at the end of the day. And my point is, yeah, that's definitely true. But so do some of your greatest liabilities. It is absolutely critical as a leader that you are clear what you are collectively trying to achieve. But it is also critical that the individuals within that, your direct reports and their direct reports and so on down, that they are clear what their part in that is. Mm. And that is partly their functional role, but that is also the cultural environment that they exist within. And we'll probably come on and talk about culture a little bit in a minute. But, you know, I definitely think that leaders shouldn't be capricious. Leaders shouldn't just, you know, shoot from the hip. And, you know, you have to create an environment where people are very clear where they stand and very clear what is expected of them in all the ways I've described. But at the end of the day, if people choose not to do that, then you have to remove those people from your teams. And in fact, often the people that suffer most from the people you've described are not you as the leader. Mm. Often those people are very good at managing up. It's actually, you know, and you think, well, they seem kind of okay and they always smile at me and are nice to me when I see them in the lift. Actually, the people that suffer most from those individuals are the people around them. They're the ones that see somebody who takes the credit for their work. They're the ones that realise they're in at 8 a.m. and that person swans in at 10:30 and leaves at 4. They're the one, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And in actual fact, in my experience, they're the ones that are most happy when you solve that, whether that be because you have a difficult conversation with that person and they change their ways or raise their game, or ultimately if that person leaves the company.
I do think it came back to something you say early on in the book about a leader should try and be connected to, you know, their shop floor, however you want to, you know, whatever the version of that is in their business, because those are the people who will have, they will have a completely different insight. And you're right, you know, those people in middle management who are often very good at upwards, because that's the person they know, you know, that's the person they know they've got to impress, and actually it comes at the expense of being a team player to everybody else. I also wonder if sometimes those people aren't happier themselves out of that environment where people are failing.
I think that is true, yes. And what we've all seen at different times is we talk about people who are talented, or, you know, we talk about talent and therefore by implication there's some people that aren't, and, you know, which we tend not to talk about as much. And I actually don't think that, generally, I don't think that's true. I think that you can put the same person, me or you or anybody else, into different environments, and we might flourish in one environment and we might struggle in another environment. And really, that is another way of looking at the leader's challenge, because the leader is the person that creates that environment. And that is culture. And there's a lot of cynicism around culture. But the reason that we're cynical about the word culture is because it's used and abused, you know, because organizations talk about what they'd like to be, you know, the values that they carve into reception that the leadership industrial complex tells them to do. But their actual reality of their organization bears no relation to it. And that's why people are cynical, because the gap between what they say and what they do is so big. If you align those two, if you create a cultural, you know, the culture is the environment the leader creates in order for their teams to outperform.
Right. And actually, weirdly, when you're managing very high performing individuals, actually dealing with failure is often harder for them. If someone has had a career where they've just excelled at every single thing, then actually the getting into that team where it doesn't work, it's not working, they can't do it, is a new and kind of freakish experience for them. And they may be very reluctant to kind of concede to that, right?
Well, I think we're definitely, most of us are reluctant to concede to that. And I don't think it's inevitable. But I mean, I don't think this isn't a binary situation. I mean, all of us in all of our lives go through all sorts, you know, work or the context we're talking about now, your time in a particular team, whether it be a sports team or work or whatever, that's only part of your life. You know, there's a whole load of other things that go on in all of our lives that we can't separate from how we are and how we feel when we're at work. And so all of us go through ups and downs and difficult times and happy times. And it's hard, you know, we talk about work life, but in reality, it's all, you can't really separate them. And I think that a good leader creates a team environment that understands that. You know, you definitely can't be capricious. You definitely got to create an environment where we understand that we all have we all share the human condition and its frailties and all that comes with it. What I'm really talking about when we talk about people that are you know, that let's say behave badly within organizations. I think that is a different thing. That isn't somebody just having a bad month.
Mm.
That's somebody who fundamentally exhibits behaviors that you as a leader and you, frankly, as a collective team, consider to be beyond the pale. And if that person repeatedly refuses, despite conversations, to change that, then that person has to leave the team for the good of the team. And I think that's critical.
Right. I think that comes back to something else that you say in the book about kind of the bad managers perpetuate the status quo because it's the line of least resistance. And there's this Colin Powell's 40-70 rule, right, which I initially thought, does Colin Powell not understand percentages? But it turns out, no, you have to take a you shouldn't take a decision until you know you think you've got a 40% chance of getting it right, right?
Yep.
But if you get to a stage where you think you've got more than 70% of the knowledge that you need, you've waited too long.
Correct.
So you have to embrace this idea that sometimes you're going to get things wrong, because otherwise, you know, you would live in an incredibly conservative, arse-covering kind of situation, right? When there's a huge, huge amount of leadership that happens where just people would rather not make a mistake than try to do something new.
I think that you asked me right at the start, why is it difficult? Why is leadership difficult? And the best way to think about that is in terms of decision making, because the way you actually get from a defined point in the present to a different point in the future is you have to travel between those two points. And what does that really mean? That means taking a series of decisions. That is just decisions, 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 decisions. Some big, some you don't even notice, some small, some you get right, some you get wrong. The most debilitating thing for a leader and a leadership team is the inability to make decisions. And I've sat in leadership teams, and I'm sure many of the people listening to this probably are right now part of teams where they meet every week and they discuss the same thing every week, and they just never come to a decision on it. And there's nothing more debilitating for an individual or a team or however big that team is than the belief that they are unable to make or unwilling to make decisions. And I think one of the reasons that people struggle with decision making is exactly to Colin Powell's point, which is they hope that if they just give it an extra week or an extra day, or they go and get an extra bit of data, or they do a bit of research, or they ask, you know, their partner or whatever it is, that in some way some sudden resolution will arrive, which will make everything clear. And that just, if that never happens. And in fact, I think that if it is absolutely 100% clear what you should do, it's not a decision, because why wouldn't you
right,
do
why
that?
Are they paying decisions you any money
only,
to take it?
Decisions only exist when there's ambiguity. And so I think as a leader, you have to reframe. And the reason people wait is because they fear failure. They fear getting it wrong. And I think what Colin Powell is saying is he's saying, accept that you're going to get some of these decisions wrong. He's saying, if you're being geeky and mathematical about it, 3 out of 10 are likely to be wrong.
Yeah.
But he's saying you have to trade that off about the need to keep making decisions. It is fear not making decisions more than fear getting some of them wrong. Because what is true is, and we see it all the time, is waiting longer actually in reality normally often doesn't make it any more likely that you are going
but
to
But I think there's also a lack of understanding that that is a decision in itself.
It's
that
exactly
delay
right.
is a decision. You have
yes.
taken a decision.
Yes.
And actually, that might very well have negative consequences yes. of its own.
It's okay, by the way, if you say there's some really good reasons why we're going to wait, then that is a conscious decision. I think the problem is a lot of times you're right, it's a decision, but it doesn't look like a decision. It just looks like dithering.
Well, I think, funnily enough, it made me think about foreign policy and going to war. And actually, you as a leader, having this conversation with a former prime minister about the fact that if you make a decision to go to war, then everybody can have an opinion on that. If you make the decision not to go to war, terrible things, I mean, I'm talking about the Syria conflict
yep.
here, terrible things may very well result from that, but those will not be attributed to you and your lack of decision, right? So there is this
well,
weird
Well, you don't
thing
have a Chilcot inquiry for not doing anything.
Right.
And I think that's a really, really important point, because actually sometimes maybe we should have Chilcot inquiry. But sometimes we should have inquiries about why we didn't do things. But it virtually never happens. There's only action that creates reaction in that
yeah,
sense.
Yeah, so the easiest thing is always to do nothing. And then you can hold your hands up. A terrible thing happened, but you weren't there. It wasn't your fault. Let's talk about culture afterwards, but we have to take a quick break.
Sponsoring the show for this episode is Marquee TV. Marquee TV is a streaming service with a difference. It's bringing you the top tier of performing arts straight into your living room or onto your device. So think dance, theatre, music, anything you might find in the West End, Broadway, or maybe a cool little experimental space too, but saving you the cost of a few tickets as well. I've got happily a bit lost in their vast library of performances, exclusive interviews, and behind-the-scenes content. Choreographer Jonathan Watkins' interpretation of George Orwell's classic 1984 was pretty cool, and I love the dance piece, Sutra, inspired by the skills of Buddhist Shaolin monks. And we've got a special treat for our listeners. Marquee TV offers 3 months of access for just 99 cents. That's right, 3 months for only 99 cents. With the code SQUARED, simply visit marquee.tv and use the promo code SQUARED to dive into the world of arts like never before. Bring the arts home with Marquee TV. The events calendar is filling up here at Intelligence Squared, and to create each one, we obviously rely on some brilliant guests and onstage talent. But behind the scenes, there's also a producer, a production team, and the budget in the mix too. You've got to keep an eye on all of that stuff in one place. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. And you can cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because it's super easy to get started. NetSuite exists in the cloud, you see, no hardware needed. So you're cutting IT costs too. That's why over 37,000 companies have already made the move. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared. netsuite.com/squared.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNADS.com.
I'm back with Chris Hurst, Global CEO of Havas Creative Network and author of No Bullshit Leadership. You talk in the book about culture. I think you have a very funny thing about the fact that Enron, the notoriously failed financial services company, had its buzzwords were kind of integrity, you know, leadership, definitely
honesty
not
and trust or something,
embezzling stuff. But actually, I think it's funny because we have this discussion in news journalism all the time about when people sort of say a compliment, you know, or say they are a thing, that no one would ever describe themselves as the opposite, right? So no one ever, says, I pride myself on my honesty. No one ever would come out and say, I think it's I pride myself on my dishonesty. Yes. So the same thing happens in those buzzwords, right? Is that everybody wants to be an innovator. And I think one of the things you said in the book, which I think is most important for people to hear, is that some people are so hung up on uniqueness. But it is okay to run a company that does a very, what was it the phrase, does a common thing.
Common thing, right, better than everybody else.
Right.
I think that's true of most companies. I genuinely do. By most, I mean, it's hard to think of ones that aren't, really. It's hard to think of companies organizations that are genuinely doing something that is unique. I'm sure somebody listening will write.
But even innovators then end up making a new market for themselves, right? Because the classic example would be something like Apple inventing, you know, the iPad, a completely new genre of product. And well, now they're now a maker of tablets competing with lots of other people. So even if you do make that, but you get a kind of 6 months to a year to enjoy your lordly innovation, if it's a good innovation.
And in actual fact, I mean, that's an example of where that was successful. Of course, there's also an equal, if not larger, list of organizations that where the people that are second or third actually end up being the most successful, because the first one, you know, somebody goes,
right,
well,
Google
that's
was
a pretty
not
good
the
idea.
First search
that's
engine.
Exactly, was not the first
We're not
search
using
engine.
Ask Jeeves anymore, sadly, or AltaVista,
So I think that back to the leadership industrial complex, one of the real sort of sources of snake oil and frankly bullshit that leaders are sold is this idea around visions and purposes and all these kind of things. And I'm not saying that those things aren't important. They are important. But so often leaders are told that those things have to be unbelievably insightful, unbelievably unique, unbelievably differentiated. And in fact, so high is often the bar is set so high that I have been in leadership teams where they've never even got beyond trying to answer that question. And I'm saying, do you know what? It's an important question, but it's not a difficult question. And in fact, it doesn't even necessarily have to be honed down to the sharpest point. It can be a direction, not a point. Because the really difficult thing is the getting between the two, is the doing it.
Okay, let's go back to the Chris S. Leadership Clinic. How do we make meetings not awful?
And meetings are awful, mm-hmm. aren't they, mostly? I think there's a lot of quite good literature. Not that I read a lot of business books, but there is quite a lot of sensible stuff written about meetings. So, again, I don't have any unique ideas about this, but I think the first thing with a meeting is somebody has to be in charge.
Yeah.
I know that's really obvious, but what I'm going to say now is incredibly obvious. Somebody has to be in charge. You have to turn up on time. And you have to finish it on time. You have to have an agenda.
If anything, finish it a bit earlier than
there's everyone. Nothing more. I mean, no even better. Even better. Nobody ever said
this meeting is too short.
Yeah. And in fact, it seems like such a kind of like trivial point. But meetings are a defining characteristic of many organisations. And we're not just talking about private sector. We're talking public sector. We're talking sports teams. They have meetings as well. And they are defining characteristics of a lot of organisations, and mostly they're run really badly. And a thing we did at a previous organisation was we tried to address this. And one of the things we did was we put in every meeting room, we put one of the chairs in the meeting room, we made a red chair, just one red chair. And the point of that was to say that whoever's meeting it is sits in the red chair. So as much as anything, it's a reminder that anytime anybody walks into that room, hang on a minute, somebody's supposed to be in charge here. Whose meeting is this? They sit in the chair, and they literally chair that meeting. Now, that doesn't always have to be the most senior person in the room. Mm. I mean, lots of meetings where there's all sorts of mixes of people. I think the other thing I'd say about meetings is that person who's sitting in that chair, they need to literally chair the meeting, not be the meeting. I think quite a lot of people whose meeting is see themselves as the meeting. So they write the agenda, they talk for most of the time, they finish. The person in that chair chairs the meeting. And we talk about culture, and I think that person doesn't just need to be sitting and making sure that we've got to agenda point three in time. They need to be sitting around the table and saying, why does that person on the left, why haven't they spoken for 30 minutes? You know, why is it that person isn't contributing to the meeting? So it's their job isn't just to hit the agenda points. Their job is to see that meeting as a mini team, and make sure that everybody is contributing. Now, it might be because they haven't got anything to add. But if you don't check in, you don't know. And I think it's really important that they are conscious of the environment as well as the agenda.
OK, next one is, how do you deal with seating plans? I have rearranged the seating plan a couple of times in companies that I've worked with, and it was honestly unbelievably stressful, which I think you acknowledge in the book, that people get really very, very tense about the idea that they might not sit in their place. I think it's kind of like a little territorial kind of thing going on.
So I love a seating plan. And in fact, that sounds such a boring thing. Everybody switches off. That sounds such a boring thing. But when we talk about leadership is about change. It's about getting from A to B. And a lot of that change in most organisations is at least partly, if often, mostly about cultural change. And a reasonable question is to say, OK, right, we understand it's cultural change, but how on earth do I actually do that? And I think culture, you have to think of culture as, we think of it as this soft, squishy thing often, like, OK, we've got a great culture because we have Pilates at lunchtime and free fruit. And my argument is that isn't culture at all. Culture, as I said earlier, is the environment leader creates for their team to succeed, and is actually, think of it like concrete. And when concrete is wet, you pour the concrete into the mold, okay, and you can squiggle on it and stick your fingers in it and things like that when it's wet. But over time, it sets. And that's what culture is like. And if you then want to change that culture, you've got to smash it. And the way you have to smash it before you can reset it. And therefore, you have to think to yourself as a leader, how do I not just say things and behave in a different way, but how do I use the environment we're within to create a different culture? And seating plans are a really interesting way to understand a culture in an organization. So we talked earlier about the Don Drapers. If we summon up Don Draper in our head, we summon up Don Draper in an office, right? We summon up his environment, and he's got a big office, hasn't he, and a drinks cabinet and a sofa. And a secretary who sits outside the door and all those kind of things. And that says something about his status and his role in that, his role and the culture as well. And one of the ways you change a culture is you change the physical environment of the organization. Seating plans are a really powerful way of doing that. So, you know, whether that be you knock all the offices down or whether you build some off, you know, change it. You know, change it to how it is. If you all sit in departments, don't sit in departments, sit in client teams. Change the way you use the environment, but do it in a way that is coherent with the story you're telling people. I mean, the critical thing with changing culture is if you just do things as a leader arbitrarily and people just go, I hate having to go and sit next to these new people because I liked my old friends. People still aren't going to be necessarily happy about it. But the critical thing is you explain to them why you're doing what you're doing. And you then follow that through with actions, one of which is changing the environment within the organisation. And seating plans are a powerful way of doing it.
Yeah, I think journalism has been through a big kind of shift on this, because over the last 10, 15 years, it's tried to integrate digital operations and old legacy print operations, right?
Classic example.
And actually saying most of those cases have involved people saying, well, actually, you know what, there isn't a prestigious print product and then this thing called the internet, which is just full of cat gifs and porn. Actually, we're going to try and sell digital subscriptions. We're going to say that our digital offering is just as pretty. That's worth paying for too. And therefore, you need to integrate those teams. But I can't think of a newspaper that I know people who worked in where that hasn't been a very angsty process.
Well, it would have been an enormous thing, I suppose, because I mean, I've never worked in a newspaper, but I presume that it started off where you had the prestigious, the real.
Yeah,
you know, the real journalist
bit. People, yeah.
Okay, and then you had the digital department
who
somewhere down there.
Younger and less well paid as well,
and
so that adds...
And presumably a crappy bit of the building, and then suddenly, and over time, that grows and develops and becomes more important, and then you suddenly get to a point where you think, oh, actually, they can't just be all 22-year-olds who sit in the crappiest bit of the building. Actually, this is suddenly going to be our future. So how do but I need the other piece as well.
Yeah.
So it's not an and or, it's how do I create a new cultural environment? That is a big strategic challenge a lot of organizations face. But what people tend not to write about in leadership books is, you know what? One of the ways you need to do that is address physically where people sit, how people sit and how they interact with each other.
Okay, we haven't got very much time, so I want to ask you some quick fire questions. We've talked a lot about bad leaders. Can you point to me to any good leaders? So let's start with politics first. Like, where would people find evidence of people having made good leadership decisions in politics, business and sport? So let's do politics first.
Wow. Good leaders in politics. Silence.
Well, I think current politics, it's hard to look around because there is a lot of exactly what you describe. I think Brexit is the classic example of people not wanting to make a choice between any of the available options, right? Because none of them are perfect. So let's not pick any of them.
I'll give you an example which in a roundabout way might answer your question. I read an anecdote about Margaret Thatcher towards the end of her life, and one of her former ministers went to see her. She lived, I think she was lived in a hotel or something, I think, when she was towards the end of life. Anyway, wherever it was. And he went to visit her, and he said, whenever I would go and see her, she'd always, despite the fact that by this point she was very old and very frail, she'd always ask how the polls were looking, okay? And he said to her, one of these last visits, he said, well, actually, Margaret, you know, they're not looking great. We're 4 points behind or something in the polls. And she said to him, you know what? That's not far enough behind at this point, because if we want to get stuff done, we're going to, you know, we have to go through a period of that being unpopular. And if we believe, I mean, it's not really a particular point, if we believe that we're right, we will see the benefit of that in the polls by the time the next election comes around. And I think there's an interesting debate about spending and saving political capital. You know, and I think that great political leaders are prepared to spend their political capital to get stuff done.
I think it's really interesting when you look at anything like minimum wage, right, now completely accepted as being a kind of just obvious common sense. Of course, you'd have a floor on the hourly wage for people. Viciously resisted at the time, arguments made that it would lead to job losses. Yep. The creation of the NHS, you know, I can't remember, I think it was Nye Bevan who said we had to stuff the doctor's mouths with gold because there was a big downside.
Yep. Ironically, the BMA who are now, firmly against it. Yeah,
and then, as you say, there has to be a point where you do something, you think, well, in the short term, maybe there will be unpopularity, but actually we think it will pay off. And again, it comes back to your point. Sport, I guess, is slightly easier. You've got an introduction in the book from Sir Clive Woodward. So
I think a great, we're talking, what is it? It's Wednesday today, 3 days after the two greatest sports contests that ever happened in this country, probably in the cricket final and the Wimbledon final.
Yeah, Federer versus
Federer Djokovic. And I think
England winning on the last ball against.
I mean,
the last ball of
the extra time
the
is like
super over,
like
which we just made
a football
up.
Game on corners. Effectively, is how it was decided, but. But I think that what was astonishing to me about both of those was the way that the losers carried themselves. Federer, the competitiveness and ability to perform under pressure for such a long period of time, and then to lose that game and to be able to deal with that in such a gracious way. And the same with Kane Williamson, the captain, for those that don't know, of the New Zealand cricket team. I mean, they lost in the way they lost that game would break a normal person. And again, his ability to create an environment that allowed his team to perform at such an astonishing high level over such a long period of time, and yet be able to deal with the deal in such a positive, inspirational, frankly, way, I think there's a lesson for us all.
There we go. Well, that is it. The book is No Bullshit Leadership, and joining me has been Chris Hurst. Thank you.
Thank you.